Welcome to Sidetrack, AM580's monthly features magazine. I'm your host, Jason Croft. This month, we have a live in-studio performance from a cool new local band called The Chemicals. We also talk to the people behind the new edgy humor magazine, The Rubberneck, and we stop into a holiday high tea. Those stories and more, this time on Sidetrack. If you think tea is just some leaves in a bag soaking in hot water, this next story is not for you. For some people, serving tea can be an occasion. At the University of Illinois Illini Union, it's an annual event. Jim Meadows reports on the annual Holiday High Tea for faculty and staff.
Yes, we know Christmas is over. But Christmas was in the air last month, and the Uni High School Madrigal Singers provided the music as the Illini Union held its annual Holiday High Tea in the Pine Lounge. There, as portraits of former University of Illinois chancellors looked on, guests, mostly well-dressed ladies, accompanied by the occasional casually dressed gentleman friend, enjoyed their tea.
We have English breakfast tea, we have original green tea, raspberry herb tea, and orange spice tea.
Okay. And we're working with tea bags. We're not snobbish in that way.
No, we're working with tea bags today.
That's Donna Eiskamp, co-chair of the Illini Union's Faculty Staff Social Committee, which has been serving an annual high tea for about 15 years. The use of tea bags would be considered a step downwards in some tea circles, but guests at the Illini Union's high tea could appreciate the variety of tea and the tea service with its silver teapot and cut glass cups. And there was the finger food, exotic enough for Social Committee Chair Ellen Sue Cameron to describe to her guests in welcoming remarks.
You obviously probably have noticed that you have a strawberry. You have smoked salmon with horseradish cream with minced onion, bruschetta ham on sourdough with fresh melon, cucumber sandwich, cream cheese and fresh dill, Russian tea cake, almond cookie with candy cherry, blueberry scone, lemon curd, chocolate cream in a white chocolate shell with candy cane, and of course, I mentioned the strawberry. And next to the strawberry is a strawberry bar.
It was the perfect Sunday afternoon outing for U of I employee Casey Harris. She says she used to have tea parties with friends before she came to Champaign-Urbana.
Yeah, I haven't seen any formal groups. I just did it with friends. I moved from Washington, D.C., and we had a lot of ritzy hotels that we would go to, and then we just started doing it at our houses. But when I saw it, I just made me think of home, so it was something I wanted to do.
Here in America, the land of the coffee break, there's something about the English tradition of tea that seems to say refinement. Actually, high tea refers to more of a working-class meal, called high because it's served on a high table, usually later in the day. The upper classes would be more likely to eat from low tables in the afternoon, and they would be the one eating the finger sandwiches, described by Cameron to her guests with this capsule recipe.
One should choose thinly sliced sandwich bread of a tight grain. A thin layer of butter is necessary to seal the bread from the moist ingredients. No polite member of society should encounter crusts. Cut away all crusts, and please cut each tea sandwich into thirds to ensure that fingers alone, only three remember, can perform the task of lifting the sandwich to the mouth. Clutching a sandwich with the entire hand is unacceptably working class.
Afternoon tea is so formal and so, to use a tea term, steeped in tradition, it's easy to forget how relatively recent it is. People have been drinking tea for at least 3,000 years, but the English afternoon tea dates back only to 1840, when Anna, the 7th Duchess of Bedford, started eating a late afternoon meal of tea, bread and butter, and cakes to keep her going until dinner at 8. Eventually, she started inviting her friends, and a generation later, afternoon tea had become an opportunity for showing off drawing rooms, new fashions, and well-polished tea services. Gathering at the Illini Union's Holiday High Tea made a good show of it during the sing-along with the Uni High Madrigal Singers, but the event doesn't draw the crowds it used to. Ellen Sue Cameron says up to 150 people bought tickets for the High Tea in past years. At last month's event, the number was around 35. Cameron hopes they can attract more people next year, people who appreciate a low-key social event amid the holiday rush.
People can come here and really relax while the hectic stuff is going on out at the mall and maybe at home, and they can come here and really relax and enjoy themselves. And they like that. It kind of is a little bit of a feeling of a little bit higher social feeling or something. It was certainly a long way from going to McDonald's, you know.
Cameron says her social committee will look for ways to boost publicity for next year's Holiday High Tea. I'm Jim Meadows.
You've got it tuned to Sidetrack. Recently, a new humor magazine has been popping up in coffee shops and other hip places around town. It's called The Rubberneck and looks more like an alternative weekly newspaper than a slick, glossy magazine. Inside are strange comics and edgy features. In their most recent issue, they have an editorial point-counterpoint debating mustaches versus kittens. In a previous issue, they've featured pumpkin carving designs with titles like Redneck Pirate, a pumpkin with a Toby Keith eye patch, Coke Binge Frankenstein, a monster version of actor Nick Nolte's mugshot photo, and The Kennedy, a pumpkin with a hole near the top. Recently, I talked with three members of the Rubberneck staff about their magazine, their approach to humor, and what, if anything, are off limits. First, I had them introduce themselves and tell a little bit about their magazine.
I'm Shane Pangburn, co-editor-in-chief of the magazine, The Rubberneck. It's somewhere in between a newspaper and a magazine. It's a magazine printed on newsprint and poorly distributed throughout this community, Champaign-Urbana and Carbondale, Illinois. It's done by two editors as well as quite a few staff writers, including Andrew Kling, but started by myself and Ted Faust. Ted is a student at the U of I, and I'm a student at Southern Illinois University, Carbondale. And the magazine was made so that we could bring a little humor into the lives of people who already have television.
Okay, so he's already introduced you guys, but let's associate names with voices here.
Okay. My name's Andrew Kling.
And you have a cold.
And I have a cold, kind of a bad one, and actually, my voice sounded pretty good yesterday. Like, it was a little deeper, and it was pretty good radio voice, so I was pretty excited. We should have done it yesterday. But I'm a junior at the U of I, and I'm a staff writer, I guess.
So, one of our lead staff writers.
Lead staff writer.
And why don't you introduce yourself over there, Ted?
Hi, I'm Ted Faust. I'm the other the part of the co in the co-editors in chief, along with Shane. We launched this thing together. Andrew's kind of our lead writer. He was pretty much in from the ground floor. We got it all started. We've gotten a few other writers since, but he's pretty much our other go-to guy in terms of really who makes the big decisions on this thing. I'm also go to U of I. I'm a junior here in creative writing.
Now, Ted, this magazine newspaper, if you will.
Call it either or both.
It hasn't been out for too terribly long, has it?
No, we got our first issue out end of October. Second issue out, we really strategically launched it in the last 3 days of finals here at U of I. We're not, you know, specifically giving it to college students. So, I mean, we got some throughout the rest of the community over in the downtown Champaign cafes and such. But, yeah, it was kind of tough. We kind of rushed it because we wanted to get another issue out before all the students left. And, yeah, we've had a little trouble getting it out there. It's a lot to take on with writing and getting it out there and all of it all at once. And
going to class, too.
And going to class.
We lack a strong business sense.
By strong, I believe he means any business sense.
Well, I want to talk to you guys more about the Rubberneck in just a moment. But in order to give the listeners sort of a feel for what you guys do on the printed page, why don't you guys read something from one of the issues?
All right. We'll read from the most recent issue, issue 2, The Moneymaker, a little feature written by another writer who's given us quite a bit of material, Ryan Wiggins from SIU. Wrote a little feature giving tips to pregnant women titled, Oops, You're Pregnant, Now What?
Oops, You're Pregnant, Now What? Tell your stomach, quote, it's about to get huger.
Start calling your future child, or stomach baby future.
Play classical music a lot so your baby will be smart, or at least one of those sophisticated psychos you see in the movies.
Prepare the dog for less attention.
Pick some cool names like Rude Dog or Esteban.
Call the milkman and tell him we won't need you anymore, then laugh and hang up.
You know, a lot of people will look at this thing when they see it in the coffee stores and bookstores, and they'll think, oh, these guys are trying to do their version of The Onion. Because, I mean, that is the most well-known humor, satire publication out there.
We've never heard of it. that's one of the concerns we had.
Do they have a website?
That was a concern we had right away because we do all love The Onion dearly. And when you hear humor magazine or humor newspaper, it's like, oh, well, The Onion. So we made a firm decision right away that we'd do no news-based humor. There are a few slips here and there, you know, but usually things which are different from what you'd find in The Onion. We try not to do any, you know, mock headlines, and we want no text on the front at all other than the name of the magazine and the informative quip humor magazine, of course. So we try to make sure we, as much as we love them, we don't want to, you know, steal from the, you know, what's already there.
So, Ted, you're basically saying that The Onion does it really, really well, and shows like The Daily Show. You know, they've got all that.
They have it covered pretty well. They have some of the most talented, funny people out there working, and I'd hate to try and compete.
Why don't you guys read something else from one of your issues?
Okay.
You got something else planned?
The Rubberneck Corporate Spotlight on Kill Pupco Incorporated. This is written by Mike Katzenstein. It all started with a joke. I'd kill puppies if it would make me rich. 18 years ago, Andrea Mara, the founder and CEO of Kill Pupco Industries, never dreamed that she would be doing just that, or that her company would be on the fast track up the Fortune 500 ladder, one of the world's fastest growing companies in the field of puppy eradication or telecommunications networks. In 1986, Mara and several business school grad friends got together and formed KPCI, with just a dream, a hope, some hard work, and several used kitchen knives. And washcloths. Lots of washcloths. They started in her mother's garage, getting work mostly through word of mouth, friends of friends. Soon, though, their small venture had grown too big to ignore, and they moved to their corporate headquarters in Northern California, where they still do business today.
You know the old saying, how many dead dogs can you fit in a two-car garage? Said Mara. Well, it's not as many as you might think. Out of the garage, they have become the nation's third fastest-growing company, doing business on 5 out of 7 continents, and more than doubling their branch offices in the past 2 bisecular quarters. They've recently added a commerce server, which will be available to the public next quarter, non-secular, hyper-partnered with a closed-loop production system in Australia to increase quality function deployment. And next year, according to sources very high in the organization, the entire KPCI family we'll be going through a total enterprise application integration.
All of this seems impressive and important in order to stay ahead of the competition, but it certainly is not the key to success. I asked Mara how she did it and how she has managed to stay on top of her field. I can't tell you everything, but I will say we have closely followed the Toyota production system. Beyond that, it's just about doing what we love and giving the customer what they want. High-speed internet products that meet today's needs for the business-minded individual on the go. Dead puppies, and coming soon, dead kittens and horses. Oh, and birds too. We're going to start doing birds.
Oh, Mike Katzenstein.
Wow.
Sorry.
That's...
Should we read something?
No, that's fine.
Nicer?
That's rather grim, granted. But that leads into a really good question. Are there things that are off limits to you? And I guess after reading that, dead puppies aren't.
No, but I mean, it's not anybody's specific dead puppy. I love puppies, and if you've read either issue of the magazine, you probably know very well that I, Ted, love kitties. And I don't know. Basically, there's some things that I think people would find offensive or objectionable in probably both these issues and probably in future issues to come, but. Basically, if it makes us laugh and we don't feel like we're directly hurting anybody's feelings or making anybody's life worse if they pick this magazine up and happen to read something, then I don't think it's off limits.
Well, humor is a very tricky business because there is that line you walk between being edgy and funny and then just being obnoxious,
Andrew Dice Clay.
Being obnoxious and gross and then getting complaints.
Yeah.
I've only received one complaint in the entire time.
Was it the Kennedy joke?
Yeah, we made first issue, we had alternate pumpkin carvings that you could do.
Sure.
And a lot of them were actually kind of silly.
That was probably the most objectionable material in the whole first issue.
Yeah.
There were little diagrams of things you could carve on pumpkins.
Yeah.
And one of them, Shane got a complaint, it was called the Kennedy.
It was just a hole in the top of a pumpkin. And, for some reason, people
thought it was like a gunshot.
I think they thought that we were alluding to the gunshot, but in reality, it just represents Kennedy getting shot in the head. which the man told me that apparently, of course, and we weren't alive when it happened, and I think that was one where we might have stepped out of our range of understanding.
It's one of those things where basically, my take is, especially in that line between what's edgy and what's vulgar, is. We're never trying to be edgy, and basically how I approach vulgarity and how I approach things that are offensive, mostly my version of it is if it's thought out and intelligent and intellectually thought about, and you know, instead of just throwing it out there to try and shock somebody, at no point are we ever throwing things out there only to try and get a reaction. We are ultimately trying to get people to laugh, and so if we think about it and you know truly consider what we're putting in there beforehand, I usually do have any problem with it. And if it's, you know, something is twisted enough, almost anything can be considered funny, and it just has to be actually thought about and moved around before you just throw it out there and hope someone laughs.
So Andrew, as a writer, what is your sort of specialty? What your sort of take on the world, the sort of humor you approach?
I don't know, it varies a lot of times. I don't think I'm that great of a writer sometimes, but they seem to like some things I write. Well, I think one of my favorite things we've done was the pumpkins, actually, because it's just kind of short visual jokes that if they're not that funny, you know, there's the next one right along. So, I don't know. I just basically do what they tell me, unless they threaten me with violence.
He brings stuff to us too. He's just being modest.
That was a pretty good combination of actually the three of us. We wrote the pumpkins. We wrote together. Ted and Andrew doing a lot of the writing, and then I did what I usually do, which is design and basically drawing of any extra art elements within the pieces.
I think Andrew's being modest, but one of the best things he can bring to me outside of he's brought some things in there written entirely by him, which are excellent, but he's also one of the best people we have in terms of just workshopping things. I think the strongest stuff in here is stuff that either all three of us worked on or, you know, Andrew and I just tossed around ideas where the ideas that one of us may have individually are actually much stronger once both of us or three of us actually move them around. And you start with, you know, one idea that's okay, but then by the end it's been morphed and twisted by, you know, two or three minds, and it works out a lot better.
Sometimes I have a hard time, like, figuring out if what I think is funny, if other people don't think it's funny. Like, sometimes I write something and I'll, like, laugh at myself, and then I'll show it to someone else, and they'll think it's pretty stupid, or, like, I have a hard time telling what's funny sometimes, and I'm pretty good at telling whether if something Ted says is funny or not. He kind of likes to bounce things off me first before he like, pursues it further.
Each one of us on our own is absolutely, completely, and totally not funny until checking with one of our friends.
So, Shane, when is issue 3 going to be out?
You know, actually, we're meeting today and into tomorrow and the next day and then whenever. And we're going to try and get it printed in a week or so, so that the first week everyone comes back to campus around January 18th through the 20th or so, we'll probably have something out.
I think another important thing we're doing is we're going to try to film some short comedy skits or short films of some sort, and try to put those on our website, too, for people to look at, because that's kind of another medium
website
that we really
yes.
like.
www.therubberneck.com. The www, that's standard, that's just World Wide Web. But the it's an article, it's the tough one. Some people are confused. It's therubberneck.com.
And my grandma went to rubberneck.com, and it was like some folk band out of Seattle.
Yeah.
And I was like, no, that's
we don't make folk music.
That's not me.
.com stands for commerce, even though we're not making money.
We're actually losing it at a rapid pace.
Sort of rapid.
And you can find the print version of The Rubberneck all around town at many different locations, so
yeah.
Go and look for it.
And if you can't find a print copy and you want one, just send an email to editors@therubberneck.com and we'll find a way to hook you up, maybe eBay or something.
That was Shane Pangburn, Andrew Kling, and Ted Faust, the main creative force behind the new humor magazine, The Rubberneck. You're listening to Sidetrack. As usual, politicians and generals led the assault on the English language last year, and their contributions topped the 30th annual list of banished words and phrases announced recently by Lake Superior State University in Michigan. Herb Trix reports.
John Shibley is one of the compilers of the annual list designed to highlight the misuse, overuse, and general uselessness of some popular words and phrases.
And it started out as a bet. Topic of conversation at a faculty party. A predecessor of mine went home that night on New Year's Eve and drew up a list of 5 words and phrases that everybody felt was overused and misused, and sent it out through United Press International. And ever since then, ever since January 1st, 1976, it has sprouted legs and has attracted followers from all over the globe.
Unfortunately, Shibley can only remember one of the hallowed first 5, and it was pet rock. One of the most nominated words or phrases for banishment from 2004 should not be a surprise. It was red states and blue states.
Especially when you consider that most of the electorate was undecided, very hard, and therefore colorblind, I guess you could say. It's very hard to slot a red state or a blue state. A lot of people long for the day when we had maps typical to what we saw in elementary schools, where different states were given different colors, the technicolor approach to learning your states when you were a kid. And they mourn the political hijacking of state colors. Flip-flopping. A lot of people remember that flip-flops are something you wear at the beach, and it's far less confrontational. Now it's taken on a very partisan tone in American politics, so they want to see that phrase waved off into the sunset.
And Americans also learned to hate the phrase, and I approved this message.
There was this huge convoluted process of campaign finance reform, and about the only tangible effect that we see are these political ads where the candidate has to come on and say, well, obviously I'm me and I approve of everything I've just said during this commercial. And it's just sort of humorous to see that happen, coming out of a long convoluted process in Washington to reform campaigning. But be that as it may, that tagline is legally, it has to run on every campaign ad to sort of manage the soft money and discern the candidate's message from other messages. But people are getting pretty tired of hearing about that. So on our list it appears.
Unfortunately, Shibley says the war in Iraq was the cause of some misuse and overuse of some words and phrases last year.
Well, these are just Pentagon terms that sort of get latched on by the popular media because they sort of, for lack of a better word, sound sexy. They seem to speak the vernacularism, the jocular, the improvised explosive device has been around since the history of warfare. It's otherwise known as a mine or a bomb. We were dealing with these things in the Vietnam War, but we didn't hear much of what IEDs or improvised explosive devices back in the Vietnam War, because I think we live in a different culture that likes to have that kind of phraseology to set the report above other reports. And after a while, it just becomes part of the style of the language, and whether or not it detracts from the original horror of the event, it tends to distance us from it. A bomb's a bomb, a mine's a mine, and can anything be less sinister if we call it by any other name?
Also nominated was the phrase enemy combatant. The person who submitted it said, are there friendly combatants, or neutral combatants, or how about enemy bystanders? If they're our enemy, just say so. But for the most part, Shibley says the purpose of the list each year is to have fun.
You know, there's some things that are best kept between you and your doctor, or, you know, you and somebody who's sworn to secrecy, and one of them is erectile dysfunction. And now it seems you can't turn the channel without running into a Viagra ad or some sort of enhancement ad that talks about erectile dysfunction.
And the linguistic abomination receiving the most votes for banishment was Izzle, attached to other words. Shibley says he'd never heard of it until the nominations came pouring in.
Knew it was some vernacularism, some hip speak. You know, we always get that every year. But I was clear. I'm clear on it now. It is sort of like using pig Latin, adding an extra vowel after a vowel. It's sort of rap Latin. For shizzle is for sure, and that's about as far as I care to venture in how to speak that kind of rap Latin. But shizzle seems to be a suffix added on to a word or phrase just to hip it up a little bit.
Other nominations for banishment include body wash, why not just call it soap, safe and effective, isn't that a requirement for any drug, and pockets of resistance. The person who submitted this one said, it sounds like someone having trouble pulling their hands out of their pants pockets.
Well, we all use words and phrases like fashion, and we may look back at a picture of ourselves many years from now and wonder what was going through our minds when we wore a certain tie or a certain kind of leisure suit. But everybody else was wearing it, and it may not have accurately reflected our tastes at the time, but we have a herd mentality, and the English language is a very rich language, and there's plenty of words and phrases that you can use to express yourself without buying into the word that's very fashionable or to the phrase that's very fashionable at the time.
Nominations are already being accepted for the 2005 list. Just go to the website for Lake Superior State University at lssu.edu. I'm Herb Trix.
Still to come on the program, a commentary from Bill Hammack and a live in-studio performance from the band The Chemicals. Stay tuned. This is Sidetrack. A new year always begins with promise. The promise of a new start, or a new way of doing things. So Bill Hammack has drawn up a list of the top five technological stories of 2004 that promise big changes in the coming decade.
The flight of a rocket tops the list. In 2004, Spaceship One flew to 62 miles above the Earth, giving its astronauts 3 minutes of weightlessness. This may seem insignificant compared to the Apollo program of the 1960s that landed Neil Armstrong on the moon, but the import of Spaceship One lies in this. It is the first private spaceflight, offering the promise of opening up the heavens to everyone. My number two story celebrates an earthbound development. Imagine if our entire nation became one large internet grid, where surfing the internet became as common as, say, electricity. Well, in 2004, U.S. and European electrical utilities began testing something called broadband over power lines. It means that an internet connection will be as close as an outlet, offering the promise of internet connectivity to areas where traditional broadband doesn't reach. And what will these new users browse? Well, that's my number three story. Google announced an ambitious plan to digitize some 15 million books from the New York Public Library, Harvard, Stanford, and Oxford universities. They'll create an online archive, making these libraries universally accessible to everyone. Technology, of course, isn't always a force for good, so my number four story shows technology getting under our skin. This year saw the rise of RFID chips, radio frequency identification chips. Now, they've been used for years in dashboard black boxes that allow cars to pass through toll gates without stopping. But 2004 saw their use inside humans. All 160 employees of the Mexican Attorney General had a chip implanted in their bodies. It lets them roam the secure areas of the office without flashing a badge. In addition, more than 1,000 Mexicans have had them implanted for medical reasons. In an emergency, doctors can download blood type, name, and other info just by scanning the patient's arm. I end with something cute. On December 27th, a U.S. company called the Genetic Savings and Clone delivered a 9-week-old kitten to a Texas woman. She paid $50,000 to have her beloved cat Nikki, who died in September 2003, cloned to produce a nearly identical kitten. Cloning seems an old story. I mean, it's used commercially to create livestock. But it makes my list as story number five because in 2004, cloning for the first time became a consumer item, the latest in conspicuous consumption. In 2005, the company will produce 9 more cats. They already have 4 clients who've coughed up $50,000 apiece to have their beloved pets cloned. Plus, the company will produce a few extra to use, in their words, as showroom models.
The comments of Bill Hammack, who teaches chemical engineering at UIUC. His essays on engineering and life, which to him are one and the same, can be found on the web at engineerguy.com. You've got attuned to Sidetrack. In the studio with me now is a new band to the Champaign-Urbana music scene. They call themselves The Chemicals, and we'll get to know them in just a bit, but right now we're going to start off with a song of theirs. This is Motormouth. It's The Chemicals on Sidetrack. That was The Chemicals with their tune Motormouth. Hi, guys.
Hello.
Hi.
Hey. Well, why don't you introduce yourselves and tell us what you do in the band. We'll start over there.
I'm Andrew. I play the drums.
I'm Justin. I sing and play guitar.
I'm Carrie. I play bass.
Johnny Chemical, guitar.
So sort of describe your music, your sound to me, because when I'm listening to it, I hear a lot of sort of different influence, a lot of sort of classic alt-rock influences. I could name them, the influences, if you want me to, but I don't want to make you guys feel self-conscious.
Oh, just a lot of bands. We all listen to different things, and we've all just kind of developed our own sound based on that, and we just work with each other, try to find something that we like.
Yeah.
Well,
I mean, I hear, like, you know, as a foundation, you know, Velvet Underground, also hearing Replacements in there somewhere, and Sonic Youth, all these bands that really helped define that alt-rock movement that was very big. Well, I mean, Velvet Underground in the 60s moving up into the 80s. Do you guys kind of see yourselves in that?
Yeah, we like all those bands.
We like to rip off chords from all the bands we like and just try to work with that.
Well, tell us about that song, Motormouth. You guys, without a doubt, have been the loudest band we've had in the studio here for an in-studio.
We're probably the quietest people on the mic. Huh?
Yeah.
Well, yeah, which is, I guess, kind of an interesting dichotomy there. Yeah. Very loud on the instruments, but kind of shy on the microphone.
I think we wrote that song in about 15 minutes.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
So, like, most of our best songs have been written like 30 minutes or so, I think.
So that's the process? You just sort of sit down and that's it?
Well, we'll just start playing together and just a riff will come out, and we'll work from there and see what happens, and then one riff to another, and keep it simple, keep it basic, and just write a song through that.
So tell us a little bit how you guys got together.
Well, let's see.
Let's have somebody who doesn't talk over here.
Yeah, that sounds like
a good idea. I don't know, how did it happen?
I have no idea.
We're the newcomers over here, I don't know.
Well, one of you guys is in the very popular band, The Blackouts. That would be Andrew over there. Right. Now, you guys in The Blackouts are sort of on the verge of breaking out.
Yes, very much so.
And so you're not only doing that, but you're with this band here. How do you juggle that?
Well, I quit my job. So basically right now I'm just doing music full time.
Yeah? And how do you personally balance the two different bands and the two different sounds and the two different group dynamics?
Well, I think it helps that I play two different instruments. And I play the drums and the chemicals. I play bass and The Blackouts, so I think that helps.
Sort of keep them separate.
Yeah.
Keep them separate.
So who do you like more then?
No comment.
Well, why don't we have you guys play another song for us? What song do you guys want to play?
Catch Me on Fire.
How about Catch Me on Fire?
Okay, is there a story behind this song?
No, there sure really isn't. Me and Andrew wrote it in my garage, and that's about all there really is to it.
Okay, this is the tune Catch Me on Fire. Here's the Chemicals on Sidetrack.
Catch me on fire.
That is the tune Catch Me on Fire from the band The Chemicals. They're live here in the WILL studios talking with us and performing a few tunes for us. They're rather new on the Champaign-Urbana scene, and you guys were a little reluctant to tell me about your origins before you played the song. Have you loosened up a little bit? Do you feel like telling me how you guys got together? I mean, is there actually a story behind it?
Well, let's see. I had started in a band a few years ago with a buddy of mine, and we were just a three-piece and didn't really go anywhere. And then I had met Andrew through a friend of mine at work and noticed that he was really good at bass, and we just started playing from there. And then we got his brother Johnny over here, Johnny Chemical, as you all know him as. And just basically started growing from there. Andrew switched from bass to drums, and we got Carrie, and now it's a four-piece, and we're finally complete.
Now, I always like to ask this of bands, local bands, when they come in and chat with me. I always try to get their opinion on what they think of the local music scene and how they feel their place is and you know, how the scene is moving along. Comments?
Oh, I just feel we're up and coming in it. You know, I don't want to think that, you know, we're too important, but I don't want to think that we're not important at all. You know, I want to try to seem that we're trying to make something of it. I don't want to make a mockery out of the scene, and I want to be a part of it. And I know a lot of certain bands have had their place, and they've really paid their dues around here, and they've worked hard at it, such as, you know, the Blackouts, and even American Minor or the Beauty Shop. They've really worked hard around here, and I would just like to be a part of something like that, you know, just try to work hard enough to where we could gain enough recognition to be seen as, you know, one of the top bands around here, one of the important bands, I guess.
Well, Justin, I'm sorry, go ahead, Carrie.
I was just going to say that I also feel like in the places that I have lived in the last few years, I think that this town really has a really like supportive music scene. I feel like all of the musicians from a lot of bands around here go to see each other play, which is really, and they always have, you know, constructive criticisms and such, and it's, I don't know, I feel really supported. You know, you don't go out and only have five people at your show, you know? I mean, it's people watch out for who's playing around town and who's new, and I don't know, I think that's great.
And it seems that they're always receptive of newer bands on the scene.
Definitely.
I mean, just in this crowded area here, we have three supporters, you know, clogging the room here.
Well, as I was going to make a comment earlier, Justin, as you were playing some of your earlier songs, the engineer who was Brian Paris, who's done a great job of mixing the
stuff
tonight.
Yes, great job. Thank you very much.
Mixing the stuff tonight. You know, he was commenting, you guys definitely have that Champaign sound that was defined, you know, a decade ago by bands like The Poster Children and Menthol.
That's
a
great compliment for him to give us.
Well, but, I mean, he was actually saying it's a stylistic thing where the vocals are kind of buried, but very powerful, and then there's just this driving guitar. I mean, when you were starting out, did you say, I want to do the Champaign sound, or is it just something organic about this town?
No, I think it's more that I can't really sing very well, and just turn the guitar up as loud as possible. That seems to work a little better.
I know, but it's funny because it is just so pervasive in the sound of the area. You guys never even thought of that.
Never noticed.
Well, I'm from Rantoul and Muhammad and two guys from Tuscola here, so
it's probably just in our blood.
Yeah,
and we don't.
I think we grew up listening to a lot of Champaign bands, though.
Well, it was hard not to.
Oh yeah,
you know.
Definitely.
Well, let's hear another tune from you guys before we get before we wrap things up. Mm-hmm. What other tune would you like to play?
This song is called Broadcasting. And
a story behind that?
I stole a riff from a friend of mine, and from there I just worked on a song, and me and Andrew just rocked it out, and another one.
Okay, here is the tune Broadcasting from The Chemicals, and they're live here in the WILL studios, and you're listening to Sidetrack. Thank you. You've got it tuned to Sidetrack. Live in the studio is the band The Chemicals, and that was their tune Broadcasting. Great tune, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
So what does the future have in store for you guys, for The Chemicals? Andrew?
More shows.
Yeah. Let's get Jonathan. He hasn't been talking much.
What's the question?
Well, what's in the future for The Chemicals? Get close to the mic.
We're going to take over the world.
Typical rock star stance. But, I mean, are you guys planning?
More songs to be written. A lot more songs. Need to work on a lot new more stuff.
Well, Carrie and Andrew and Justin and Jonathan, thank you guys for coming in.
Thank you so much, sir.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah. And you're listening to Sidetrack. Well, that does it for another edition of Sidetrack. Jay Pierce is our senior editor, and I'm your executive producer and host, Jason Croft. And special thanks go out this month to engineer Brian Paris for his work with our live in-studio performance. This episode, as well as all our past episodes, are available in real audio on our website. And a lot of our past shows are also available as MP3 downloads. Just go to WILL.UIUC.edu, click Listen, and then select Sidetrack. Sidetrack is a production of AM 580, WILL, Urbana.